water go into the septic tank. Nowadays, most of us think that to keep our yards clean, we have to wash them with tap water every week. While in the past, although the problem of water was not as serious in Iran as it is now, and the population was not as big, people would clean their yards with sprinkles of water and a broom. And the purpose was to prevent dust from rising when sweeping. In the past, there weren't as many cars that needed to be washed with drinking water every few days. But today, millions of liters of water is consumed every year to wash the millions of vehicles across the country. I came to realize the importance of drinking water in recent years. On one of my trips to this same Baluchistan region, I ended up bathing with only 3 liters of water after going without a wash for a whole week. It was a time when the people here were grappling with a drought. That incident led me to understand the importance of drinking water in Iran. I now understand why we shouldn't let even a single drop of it go to waste. This is one of the oldest houses in this whole area. In this whole village. And Haji Khodabakhsh was in fact born in this same house. He's giving me a tour of the interior. The houses in the village of Nilag are beautiful and traditional. But there is one house in this village that is very old, very beautiful, and unique. In Baluchi language, this house is called a kud. It is dark in the house. There is no electricity, no running water, and not even a room. This is all there is to it. The owner says that all the members of the family, and there were 9 of them, used to live together in this house that is no more than one big lounge. But despite all the deprivations, the members of the family are as close as ever. The Baluch are a very kind, family-loving people. I feel an eerie feeling of calm among these pure souls. Baluch hospitality makes any stranger visiting these parts feel at home in their houses. You feel like you were born and raised in one of these houses and lived a good, simple life growing up with these genial and warm people. Most of the Baluch people who don't go fishing at sea are herders, and in this area, camels are the best livestock to keep. Camels have adapted very well to the environment and climate of Baluchistan. My journey is coming to an end. Shir Muhammad tells me about one of his friends. Mr. Shah Bakhsh is one of the main camel herders in the region. The old camel rider tells me about Baluch kindness towards all of the world's creatures. Kindness embedded in the culture of this people. The Baluch are a very kind and passionate people, traits that are evident in the words of Mr. Shah Bakhsh. When I ask him if he's ever tried camel meat, he says the Baluch normally do not eat camel. That's because camels are loved by these people, and so they don't have the heart to slaughter them, much less eat their meat. I have arrived at the end of my trip, a trip that taught me many valuable lessons about the Baluch people and Baluchistan. This is a province with a beautiful, unspoiled environment. A place where the sea meets the mountains and plains. The Baluch people, with their rich ancient culture, are a source of great pride for Iran. I too am proud of these honest, kind people. Proud of having such generous fellow countrymen and women. The Sea of Oman looks like a drop of water against the unfathomable hearts of these people. All I want for the people here is proper, stable jobs compatible with their culture and environment, created by competent and caring government officials. I hope for facilities and development to come to this part of my country without doing any damage to its ancient culture and pristine environment.
Well, perhaps Iran's internationally renowned mosques and ancient remnants of Isfahan and Shiraz are what attracts most visitors from far and wide. But I'm sure many nature-loving individuals have become interested in visiting Iran's southernmost region and the pristine natural wonders of Sistan and Baluchistan. And that's it for this week, everyone. Thank you. Do join me again next time here on Aperture for another documentary. Goodbye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
For the majority of Americans who are so poor they barely have to pay income taxes, Scott's plan is just the latest in a 40-year barrage of assaults and insults coming from the GOP, says Tom Hartman, writer, in an article published under the heading, "The GOP is actually running on raising taxes on the poor and destroying medicine and social security." Here's the story. Republicans want to raise taxes on poor and working class Americans, and social security and medicine, jack up pollution and corporate profits, all while continuing to pamper their billionaire donor base. This time, it's the guy in charge of getting Republican senators elected and re-elected, Florida Senator Rick Scott. You may remember him as the guy who ran the company convicted of the largest Medicare fraud in the history of America, who then took his money and ran for governor of Florida, where he prevented the state from expanding Medicaid for low-income Floridians for all the years he ran the state. Now he's the second richest guy in the Senate. And IMHO, the leading candidate for the GOP nomination for president in 2024. And true to form, he is echoing the sentiments of the richest guy in the Senate, Mitt Romney, the last guy before Trump to have that nomination. Ron said of Obama voters back in 2012, there are 47% who are with him, who are dependent upon government, who believe that they are victims, who believe the government has a responsibility to care for them, who believe that they are entitled to health care, to food and housing, you may name it. There are people who pay no income tax. Low-income working people in America generally pay a higher percentage of their income as taxes than do most of U.S. billionaires and multi-millionaires. They pay Social Security taxes, Medicare taxes, property taxes, sales taxes, taxes in the form of fees for everything from a driver's license to road tolls to annual car inspections. As Romney pointed out, though about 47% of Americans in 2012 made so little money that after applying the standard deduction, they paid no income tax. This doesn't just reveal how few people pay taxes, though. To the contrary, it reveals how many Americans are living in or on the edge of poverty. The simple reality is, if you want more people to pay income taxes, all you have to do is raise working people's pay. We saw this in a big way between 1950 and 1980 when Keynesian economics reigned and labor unions held wages, and the taxes they paid steadily rise for working people. But Republicans don't like the idea of what they call wage inflation. They'd rather just squeeze working people harder while continuing their subsidies of the lifestyles of the morbidly rich donor class. More than half of Americans make so little money from their employment that they can't deal with an unexpected $1,000 expense like a car accident or medical bill. And it's these very people who Rick Scott and the GOP believe need to be further taxed so they will have what Scott calls skin in the game. In the early years of the Reagan administration, before his neoliberal trickle-down and supply-side policies started to really bite Americans, only 18% of Americans were so poor and their income didn't qualify to be taxed. As a right to work for less laws spread across America and Republicans on the Supreme Court made it harder for unions to function, more and more working people fell below the tax threshold. Today, it takes two working adults to maintain the same lifestyle that one worker could provide in 1980. So an estimated 61% of working Americans this year will make so little pay that their income isn't subject to taxation. Rick Scott and the GOP's solution to this situation isn't to raise the income of working class people. Quite to the contrary, they are suggesting that low-income people should be hit with their very own income tax, in addition to the dozens of other taxes they're already paying. Also, multimillionaires and billionaires like Scott and his friends can hope to see their own taxes go down a tiny bit. Doing his best imitation of New Gingrich, Scott has rolled out his 11-point plan to soak the American middle class, lock down elections, destroy consumer protections, increase pollution and climate change, and squeeze a few more dollars out of every family, no matter how tight their budgets may already be. Scott calls this rescuing America, and it may be true if you're morbidly rich and made your money spewing pollution or hustling opioids. His plan not only calls for a 50% cut in the IRS workforce, presumably to end all audits of rich people like Scott, but also demands all federal legislation to sunset within 5 years. That would almost certainly end Social Security and Medicare programs that have been in the crosshairs of Republicans since Reagan's day. Realizing how raising taxes on 60% of Americans' voters will play in campaign ads, Mitch McConnell has backed away from Scott's bizarre proposal. But Fox News is all over it, inviting Scott on repeatedly to hawk his plan and prepare the ground for his candidacy. After all, billionaires like Rupert Murdoch and his family need their tax breaks. As Sean Hannity told Scott during a recent appearance, "I want to applaud you. I'd like to see the House and the Senate come together on these issues, make these promises to the American people, get elected, and then fulfill those promises." No doubt, multimillionaire Hannity was speaking his own words. But for the majority of Americans who are so poor, they barely have to pay income taxes, Scott's plan is just the latest in a 40-year barrage of assaults and insults coming from the GOP.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
As the war between Russia and Ukraine drags on, there are indications that Ukraine has hosted U.S.-funded labs to develop biological weapons. U.S. Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs Victoria Nuland has admitted that Ukraine hosts biological research facilities.
Ukraine has biological research facilities, which, in fact, we are now quite concerned Russian troops, Russian forces may be seeking to gain control of. So we are working with the Ukrainians on how they can prevent any of those research materials from falling into the hands of Russian forces.
So that Victoria Nuland, the guru of the Maidan, who was passing out cookies to the fascist Azov battalion in 2014 during the coup against the legitimate government, was forced to admit that these facilities were there. She didn't clarify what they were exactly, but she indicated that they were dismantled quickly in order to prevent them from falling into the hands of the Russians.
The admission came after Russia published documents showing that Kiev was ordered to urgently eliminate traces of what was deemed as a biological weapons program financed by the Pentagon. The dangerous pathogens across Ukrainian biolab facilities included anthrax, the plague, tularemia, cholera, and other deadly diseases. In the past several days, long-standing fears, which we have expressed repeatedly for years, regarding the development of military biological materials by the United States on the territory of Ukraine under the auspices of the relevant U.S. Special Services have been confirmed. Earlier, the Russian Defense Ministry said it had found evidence of U.S.-funded biolabs in Ukraine, which had urgently destroyed samples of deadly pathogens when the military offensive started.
I think the United States was caught by surprise now. At first, they've been denying all the accusations that are being made, you know, over the past few months that they're conducting biological warfare research, you had this incident here, which initially they really couldn't deny.
Russia says U.S. statements about Ukraine's biolabs indicate fears by Washington that the pathogens stored there may fall into the hands of Russian experts. Moscow says they confirmed the U.S.'s violation of the Biological and Toxin Weapons Convention.
So either through surrogate or directly, the United States seems to have been involved in creating a capability give a country, an allied country, or the United States, a possibility to conduct biological warfare. And that, of course, is is forbidden by a variety of UN conventions.
Russia says it had been closely monitoring the bioweapons programs that were developed by the Pentagon in post-Soviet countries. Russia has accused the U.S. of working in Ukraine since 2005 and being involved in the construction, modernization and operation of over a dozen biolabs suitable for storing or working with pathogens, including those used in bioweapons.
The fact that they existed in Ukraine, where there was a almost obsessive concern and hatred, I must say, among some of the leading factions, right-wing factions in the Ukrainian government against Russia, that they, I think, would be quite prepared to use them in a war with someone they considered their deadly foe. And if they did so, it was with the whole backing of the United States, who set up these facilities in the first place.
Moscow has expressed deep concerns about these facilities in recent years. Moscow says facilities in Ukraine were developing components for biological weapons, noting that in the near future, the ministry would release its analysis of the received documents. Russia also accuses the U.S. of sponsoring biological labs across a number of former Soviet republics, including Kazakhstan, Armenia, Tajikistan, and Georgia.
The Aerospace Force of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps successfully put a reconnaissance satellite into orbit. The Noor-2 was launched from Imam Khomeini Spaceport in Semnan Province. The satellite reached a low orbit of 500 kilometers above the Earth on an Iranian three-stage Qaset carrier, which used a combination of liquid and solid fuels. The Noor-2 became Iran's second military satellite successfully placed in low Earth orbit. Commander of the Space Command of the IRGC's Aerospace Force said Iran's national space and defense organizations, knowledge-based companies, and universities cooperated in the Noor-2 project. Brigadier General Ali Jafarabadi explained that the domestically manufactured satellite incorporates the newest technology. It is the upgraded version of Noor-1, which was launched into orbit 21 months ago. Data obtained by Iran's second military satellite can have multiple general and defensive uses. The Noor-2 will orbit the Earth every 90 minutes and will pass over the Iranian sky 16 times every day. Its mission will last at least 3 years. The commander explained that the IRGC will launch a series of Noor satellites in the coming years to consolidate its position in low Earth orbit before aiming for the orbit 36,000 kilometers above land. The latest achievements of Iran's space program came a few days after the IRGC unveiled two underground bases housing state-of-the-art missiles and attack drones. Iran has been relentlessly developing new weapons and military equipment, arguing that it needs the means to defend itself in the world's most volatile region. Just weeks ago, the country unveiled a state-of-the-art ballistic missile with pinpoint precision. Khaybar Shikan boasts high maneuverability when it dives down, making it a nightmare for the world's most advanced missile shields. Iranians have stressed that their defense program grew out of the war initiated by Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein in the 1980s. Saddam's forces showered Iranian cities with missiles and bombs provided by the East and the West, while Iranians say no one sold them any proper means of defense. Iranians argue that they have no choice but to build their own defense industry. The latest achievements strongly suggest that Iran's pursuit of robust defense capabilities is in full swing despite stringent American sanctions.
I think that these developments send several interrelated messages, the first and foremost being that Iran's technological development will not be held back by the obviously failed efforts of the United States and its allies to curtail Iranian technological development. It sends another similar message regarding sanctions, that sanctions are going to be completely ineffectual in terms of holding back Iran's scientific as well as industrial development.
Iran is still engaged in the negotiations in the Austrian capital aimed at removing the sanctions, but its defense industries are not waiting for the talks to end in an agreement. Observers believe Iran's launch of a military satellite into orbit as talks in Vienna are still underway is sending a clear message that it will never negotiate over its defense capabilities and that no agreement can ever restrict its defense, missile, and space programs. The Islamic Republic has made it clear that it will never ask for permission from anyone to manufacture its own means of defense.
The world is closely watching the Russia-Ukraine conflict as it can potentially end in outcomes that would send shockwaves across the globe. Russia launched what it calls a special military operation to demilitarize and denazify Ukraine. That came despite weeks of warnings from Western capitals that such a move would bring catastrophic results. The United States and its allies decided not to confront Russia directly and resorted to supporting Ukraine with intelligence and military hardware. They launch another war that isn't fought with bullets or rockets, but affects banks and financial institutions, an economic war. Washington and its allies have announced several rounds of sanctions on Russia, mostly targeting its banks and energy sector. The scrapping of the highly anticipated Nord Stream 2 pipeline project that would transfer Russian gas directly to Germany was among the measures. Moscow has already warned that it could cut its gas supplies to Germany via the Nord Stream 1 pipeline.
The implications of this event on the economy, the implications of this for the Russian economy, I don't think are quite as tragic as some of the Western press would like to have us believe, because I believe that the Russians have a great many more shock absorbers because they are less exposed than many of the Western capitalist economies.
The tensions risk escalating into a wider energy crisis in Europe, which has over the past year experienced shortages of fuel and price hikes. The military conflict and ensuing sanctions are already showing their effects, but not only on Russia. Deputy Prime Minister Alexander Novak said crude prices could surge to over $300 per barrel if the U.S. and European Union ban imports of oil from Russia. Oil prices have already spiked to close to $140 per barrel, the highest since the 2008 financial crisis. Western sanctions on Moscow, coupled with logistics turmoil, have also shaken markets for other commodities. U.S. wheat futures rose more than 7%, nearing an all-time high amid fears of supply chaos. European wheat has already hit record highs as deepening Western sanctions against Russia fueled concerns about exports from the Black Sea region. Russia is the world's biggest wheat exporter. Russia and Ukraine account for about 29% of global wheat exports. In stock markets, European shares fell to their lowest in a year, with Germany and Italy's benchmark index slipping into a so-called bear market.
The economic impacts of this crisis, of this war, is not something that we're going to be able to that the world will not be able to undo, even if there is a peace treaty in the short term, because the disruptions and the lack of confidence in the old geopolitical arrangements is a permanent damage that will profoundly affect the world economy.
What should be taken into account is that you can't simply remove a cog from the system and expect it to continue working without a hitch. Sanctions might hurt Russia for the short term, but in the long run, everyone will lose.
A U.S. delegation of senior State Department and White House officials traveled to the Venezuelan capital, Caracas, to meet with President Nicolas Maduro's government. The meeting is the highest-level visit by U.S. officials to Venezuela in years. It also coincides with an ongoing conflict between Russia and Ukraine. The question is, why should such a meeting take place at this time? Venezuela and the U.S. severed all diplomatic relations in 2019 following Washington's recognition of pro-U.S. opposition leader Juan Guaido as Venezuela's interim president over the legitimate president Nicolas Maduro. The U.S. then imposed sanctions on individuals with ties to Maduro's government and on companies involved in exporting Venezuelan oil to provoke regime change in the Latin American country. Venezuela soon felt the impact of sanctions as its oil production reduced significantly. In response, Caracas turned to Russia as well as Iran and China for diplomatic and economic aid. Russian energy companies and banks have since played a major role in Venezuela's exporting of oil. Fast forward to today, Russia is involved in a conflict with Ukraine. Russian President Vladimir Putin says he will only halt his country's military operation if Ukraine is stopped fighting and if Moscow's demands are met. On the other hand, Western governments have targeted Russia with a barrage of sanctions. The U.S. has imposed a ban on the exports of specific technologies to its oil refinery sector. Washington has also blacklisted over a dozen of Russian entities with ties to the country's military and defense sectors. Meanwhile, European Union has excluded 7 Russian banks from the global SWIFT payment system. The bloc has also banned 2 major news networks, namely Russia Today and Sputnik. And Germany has decided to freeze the Nord Stream 2 project. In a bid to punish Russia for attacking Ukraine, the US and its allies targeted Moscow's oil and gas sector via sanctions. And countries like Venezuela are potential substitutes. In addition, while the war in Ukraine continues unabated, Washington is paying closer attention to Moscow's allies in Latin America. Current and former U.S. officials believe that's because Washington thinks they could become security threats if the standoff with Russia deepens.
The U.S. is going to try to divide Russia from Latin America and the Caribbean. And interestingly enough, according to the White House itself, a lot of the sanctions imposed on Russia over this whole Ukraine nonsense are designed to target Venezuela, Cuba, and Nicaragua because those countries are also sanctioned by the U.S. And those countries are also dependent on Russia for aid. Russian support and aid is one of the main reasons why these countries have been able to overcome the sanctions to begin with. So in a sense, the U.S. is targeting these countries indirectly by hitting Russia, and I think people are not going to fall for it.
In a public speech on Thursday, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro stated that his country is open to discussing oil deals with investors from all around the world, including the U.S. In case Washington restricts the imports of Russian oil, Venezuela would be able to replace some of the lost supplies. The U.S. sees Latin America as an opportunity to advance its agenda among Latin American countries allied with Russia. But the U.S. is not that popular in Latin America for many reasons. In a slightly less than 100 years, from 1898 to 1994, the U.S. intervened successfully to change governments in Latin America at least 41 times, or once every 28 months for an entire century.
The U.S. has launched a number of military coups to try to overthrow the left-wing government in Venezuela. It has used all diplomatic and sanction means to try to do so. None of this has worked because the Venezuelan government has the backing of the people and also internationally has the support of countries like Russia, Iran, China, Nicaragua, Cuba, and many others that stand in solidarity with the Venezuelan government.
The United States has long interfered in the internal affairs of Nicaragua, a Latin American country it once occupied from 1912 to 1933 as part of the Banana Wars. Washington has imposed sanctions against Nicaragua's government and President Daniel Ortega's inner circle since 2018 when protests erupted in the country. Meanwhile, Cuba suffers from chronic shortages of electricity and food exacerbated by brutal U.S. sanctions. It also holds Washington responsible for stirring up violence in the country and blames its economic woes mainly on U.S. embargoes. And there is a long list of other countries in the region that have been victims of the U.S. sanctions and its intervention in their domestic affairs. While Washington seeks to find a substitute oil producer to fill in the place of Russia to further pressure Moscow by imposing stricter sanctions on its oil and gas, U.S.'s dark history continues to haunt it. Will Putin's Latin American allies stay loyal to him, or will they forget all hardship the U.S. has inflicted on their people for years?
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Saudi Arabia has executed 81 men over the past 24 hours, including 7 Yemenis and 1 Syrian national, on charges including terrorism and holding deviant beliefs. State news agency SBA said on Saturday, 12th of March. The article you're about to hear has been written by staff at the Reuters news agency. The piece is titled, Saudi Arabia Executes 81 Men in 24 Hours. Saudi Arabia has executed 81 men over the past 24 hours, including 7 Yemenis and 1 Syrian national, on charges including terrorism and holding deviant beliefs, state news agency SBA said on Saturday, 12th of March. The number dwarfed the 67 executions reported in the Saudi kingdom in all of 2021, and the 27 executions in 2020. These individuals were convicted of various crimes, including murdering innocent men, women, and children, the state news agency SBA said, citing a statement from the Saudi Interior Ministry. Crimes committed by these individuals also include pledging allegiance to foreign terrorist organizations such as ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and the Houthis, the statement added. Some traveled to conflict zones to join terrorist organizations, the state news agency SBA said. The men included 37 Saudi nationals who were found guilty in a single case for attempting to assassinate security officers and targeting police stations and convoys, the report added. Saudi Arabia's human rights record has been under an increasing scrutiny from human rights groups all over the world and Western allies since the murder of distant Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi in 2018. Saudi Arabia has faced strong criticism of its restrictive laws on political and religious expression and the implementation of the death penalty, including for defendants arrested when they were minors. Saudi Arabia denies accusations of human rights abuses and has tried to justify the executions by saying its national security was threatened. Meanwhile, a new report from Saudi Arabia has suggested that at least three members of a Saudi hit squad convicted by the kingdom of murdering Jamal Khashoggi are living and working in seven-star accommodation inside a government-run security compound in Riyadh. The new report originates from a source connected to senior members of Saudi intelligence. The assassins are believed to be staying in villas and buildings run by Saudi Arabia's state security agency, far from the walls of its infamous prisons. The source has spoken to two witnesses who claim to have seen the men. They said family members frequently visit the men, who are able to use a gymnasium and workspaces on the site. All were sentenced before a Saudi court in a trial broadly condemned as a sham, though only one of them, Salah al-Tobagi, was named. Some received death sentences which were later commuted to life terms. The sightings cast further doubt on Riyadh's claims to be holding the murderers of Jamal Khashoggi to account, and come as Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's most trusted advisor, Saud al-Qahtani, has re-emerged in the royal court after 3 years in hiding. Saud al-Qahtani was acquitted of any involvement despite a Western intelligence assessment that he has masterminded the assassination of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi at Prince Mohammed bin Salman's behest. The source confirmed that Salah al-Tobagi, the forensic scientist who dismembered Jamal Khashoggi inside the Saudi consulate building in Istanbul, was one of those seen inside the facility. Mustafa al-Madani, the body double dispatched by the hit squad team to create the ruse that Jamal Khashoggi had left the consulate building alive, has also been seen, as has Mansour Abu Hussein, who is accused of leading the operation. Both witnesses have visited the compound on several occasions in the past 2 years. They say the men were relaxed and appeared to be performing normal duties. Visitors, including caterers, gardeners, technicians, and family members, frequently attend the compound, according to the intelligence source. The sightings of Salah al-Tobagi, Mansour Abu Hussein, and Mustafa al-Madani took place in late 2019 and towards the middle of 2020. The witnesses would not publicly disclose their names for fear of retribution from Prince Mohammed bin Salman and by state security, which wields a heavy hand in Saudi Arabia. Mansour Abu Hussein and Mustafa al-Madani are known to be intelligence officers employed by the Saudi state security. Their boss, Abdul Aziz bin Mohammed al-Huwairini, has been seen with some of the accused and is often spotted using the compound gymnasium. In December of 2019, after proceedings shrouded in secrecy, a Saudi court acquitted three defendants, sentenced five more to death, and a further five to prison terms. The five men sentenced to death were not organizers, and were eventually legally pardoned in May of 2020 by Jamal Khashoggi's children in an arrangement brokered by Prince Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince. Little has been revealed until now about the whereabouts of the main players in the murder plot, but their apparent presence in a modern, well-equipped intelligence compound in Riyadh, where they enjoy freedom of movement, is starkly at odds with assurances by the Saudi royal family that the perpetrators of the murder face tough punishment.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
A two-day summit of European Union leaders in Versailles, France, to discuss Russia's military operation in Ukraine concluded with increasingly belligerent rhetoric possibly overshadowing the rejection of concrete sanctions. Led by the Eastern members of the bloc, the EU will not impose sanctions on Russian gas and oil. In mid-May, a proposal could be unveiled to phase out Russian fossil fuels by 2027. The Western members of the bloc led the swift rejection of Ukraine's appeal for fast-track membership to the bloc. The EU and NATO claim they have excluded direct military intervention in Ukraine. The EU did double to 1 billion euros the amount of military aid for Ukraine. It's the first such military involvement for the bloc, which was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2012.
There have been three strategic objectives which Russia did not anticipate. First, the resurrection of NATO. Second, the awakening of Europe. And third, the unity of Ukrainians. I think the Russians had a bad strategy.
Some in Europe are saying that Russia's military action is on the same level as 9/11 and that the EU must bolster cooperation on defense and drastically boost military spending.
Europe needs its own army. After the 1980s, Europe became disarmed and completely reliant on the Americans. Ukraine is the door to Europe, and now Europe has no choice but to arm itself. Europe needs to reconceptualize its own image into one where they can defend themselves.
If the EU follows through on some of these promises and sanctions, Europe will likely see a multi-year effect on prices of food, energy, and basic goods. The green transition, which some think is so vital, will likely need to be reversed. The summit ends much as it began. It's not fully clear how far the EU will go to get involved in the conflict between Russia and Ukraine. A poll last month showed that two-thirds of France is favorable to organizing a referendum on leaving the European Union. If massive and controversial changes aren't approved by a democratic vote, it's possible that the EU may be fomenting even more discord. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
As Yemenis experienced the worst fuel shortage since the beginning of the Saudi-led war in 2015, Yemen's petroleum company held a press conference to highlight the impact of the Saudi piracy acts in the Red Sea.
In 2021, the Saudi-led coalition prevented entry of fuel needed to meet 95% of the general need for fuel. This shows that the Saudi-led coalition uses fuel as a pressure card amid the ongoing war. This is a clear violation of the international humanitarian law. The situation is dangerous, especially with the rise of oil prices internationally due to the Russian-Ukrainian conflict.
Officials say the purpose of the Saudi-led coalition seizure of fuel ships is to raise the price of fuel and spread chaos in the country.
The Saudi-led coalition is continuing its siege, intending to raise fuel prices. They believe the rise in fuel prices will force people to go out to the streets and protest. But the Yemenis have proven to the Saudi-led coalition that they know who causes the fuel crisis, and they hold the United Nations responsible for its continued silence.
Besides the war, Saudi Arabia and its allies have imposed an all-out blockade on Yemen since March 2015. The United Nations describes Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis, but it has not taken any action to end the suffering of millions of Yemenis.
Experts believe Saudi Arabia's recent measures to block Yemen's fuel imports are yet another proof that the Saudi military operation against Yemen is a failure. And they also say the Russia-Ukraine conflict has exposed the international community's double standard on humanitarian crisis. Abdulatif Roshali, Sana'a.
Around the world with reporters.
Back on March 11, 2012, a U.S. Army sergeant horrifically killed at least 16 civilians, including 9 children, and wounded 6 others in Panjwayi district of Kandahar province. Today, Afghans recall the killings as shocking and inhuman, saying they can't forget about the U.S. war crimes in their country.
Around 10 years ago, a terrifying shooting was carried out on my relatives in the Zangawad village in Kandahar. It was like a nightmare. I can't forget it. American forces opened fire on civilians, including children and women. We did protests against the U.S. and didn't let them sweep it under the carpet. Americans should be held accountable for their war crimes in Afghanistan.
Syed Ishaq Gilani was a former Afghan MP. He led the Afghan team to investigate the Panjwayi mass killing. He denies an individual act, saying it was planned and more Americans were involved.
Throughout our investigation, we found out that there was more than one shooter. We saw 20 footprints of the American forces at the scenes of crimes. The incident was shocking and tragic. It looked like a group of U.S. soldiers had done that. Then they blamed everything on one of their drunk teammates. The U.S. forces threatened the local people not to tell us the truth.
Sardar Muhammad, the lawyer of the victim's family, says that the U.S. Army threatened him and didn't let him pursue the file.
After the mass killing, the victim's family chose me as the lawyer. At a 2 rounds of trial, the American sergeant Robert Bales was sentenced to death, and it was what the family wanted. But before going to the last trial, Americans threatened me because I was insisting on execution of the murderer. I don't know what happened in the last trial, as the Americans selected one of themselves as the lawyer of the victim's families instead of me.
After 20 years of invasion, the U.S. and its allies hastily abandoned Afghanistan in mid-August last year, leaving Afghans with sad and heartbreaking memories. People in Afghanistan associate the U.S. invasion of their country with destruction, nightraids, and rights violation. They say the U.S. should be held accountable for its war crimes in Afghanistan. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
At the Palace of Versailles, famed as the seat of absolute autocracy and anti-democracy, the leaders of the European Union met in order to discuss possibly historic reversals of long-standing policies as a response to the conflict between Russia and Ukraine.
The challenge is to leave the summit with a firm declaration that a peak of new sanctions is reached, that they will be applied, and that everyone is ready to move towards the same decisions, such as freezing assets of both the Russian central bank and private banks, sanctions on those close to Europe, and reducing gas purchases.
Russia is the biggest supplier of fossil fuels to the European Union, and the meeting will discuss how to reduce as much as 2/3 of its natural gas needs from Russia within a year. That is expected to be extremely painful for businesses and households, and would force a reversal of green energy policies, which many European politicians have insisted were of apocalyptic importance for many years. One of the key arguments often used to defend the EU is that it is responsible for an era of European peace. But many say the 2-day conference may provide the foundations for a new European army. For the first time, the EU has sent lethal weapons, even though the bloc won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2012. More than half of Europe has already sent arms to Ukraine, further escalating the conflict.
There needs to be a form of strategic autonomy, which Macron keeps repeating. And if not independence, then less dependence from both Washington and Moscow. The consequences of this conflict will be felt on Europe, so Europe needs to show unprecedented unity and swiftness.
To fund these changes, the leaders are discussing a potentially massive bond sale similar to the bloc's $2 trillion COVID rescue fund, and which they refused to do during the age of austerity. The latest round of Russia-Ukraine peace talks in Turkey failed to make any progress at all. The fallout from the conflict in the Ukraine is provoking massive shifts in historical developments and with a rapidity that few imagine possible. If the two countries can't make peace soon, the world may look very different very quickly. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Nigerians under the umbrella of the concerned Abuja indigenes said the Nigerian government's refusal to release the travel documents of Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki and his wife Zinat is part of the unjustifiable oppression of the Islamic cleric and his wife. The group said Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki has been brutalized in Zaria in December 2015, resulting in the murder of his six sons and thousands of his followers. They said the Islamic cleric has remained resolute and law-abiding, so there is need for the court to resolve the issue of his travel documents immediately.
Do we expect him dead before the judgment concluded? This is what we are talking about. If the court should keep on delaying, consigning the release of the traveling document, what do we do while the sickness keep on eating the body?
The Abuja concerned indigenous said Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki and his wife Zinat have dangerous levels of lead and cadmium in their blood and needed to be hospitalized. They said delaying the medical trip of Sheikh Zazaki and his wife Zinat is an infringement on their rights.
The Constitution of Nigeria has given every individual a right to express, right of movement, right to medication, right of everything, socially. So if right has been given to every individual citizen of the country, why is Sheikh being deprived?
A Kaduna High Court had freed Sheikh Zazaki and his wife Zinat since July 28, 2021. The Islamic cleric and his wife had dragged the Nigerian government to court over its refusal to release their passports to go for medical treatment abroad. Danjum Abdullahi, Abuja.
Already struggling with the cost of living crisis, ordinary Europeans are now feeling the pinch at the pump, with the conflict in Ukraine pushing up the already high food and fuel prices. As plans to phase out oil imports from Russia are drawn up, the ripple effects of the Ukraine crisis are being felt across the continent.
Here in London, people are feeling the economic cost of the ongoing military conflict in Ukraine at the gas pump. Prices have been rising steadily since the start of the year and have now hit a record high. And what that means is that it's going to have a knock-on effect on the cost of transporting goods and, by extension, on the already rising cost of living.
Russia is the world's second largest exporter of oil. The EU imports 27% of its oil from Russia, the UK 11%, and the US just 8%. Which is why Europe will feel the effect of the bans far more acutely than the US. The EU also plans to slash its dependency on Russian gas by two-thirds this year. That's 26% of their supply.
It's hard, bloody hard, but it's possible if we're willing to go further and faster than we've done before.
But to make it possible, experts say, the Europeans will have to make difficult compromises.
For the new government in Germany actually now saying, actually, we're going to bring back nuclear. Well, that was one of the key things, that they were going to get rid of nuclear completely, very quickly indeed. Then also coal, getting rid of the coal-burning power stations, and particularly those from maybe the using Polish coal, brown coal, which is incredibly dirty.
But could all this have been prevented? While the U.S. and Europe blame Russia's ongoing military offensive in Ukraine for the soaring energy costs, some experts say it's a crisis that could have been averted.
One of the great things about international affairs is to understand not just what you want to achieve, but what the other side wants to achieve. And where's the middle path? Russia generally would want to have a working relationship to protect its security, to make sure its confidence is there. And, you know, instead of necessarily having people who are American allies literally a few hundred miles away from your capital, that's something they're not used to. So really understand their nervousness, now try and work out how to deal with it. But we've left it too late.
The new plans will mean less oil revenues for Russia and a faster transition to cleaner energy. But what it also means is a higher risk of inflation and recession across the continent. Saeed Pourriza, London.
Yuan has launched its futures contracts for the first time in the history of its energy exchange market. The futures contracts were launched for the naphtha and methanol trades. According to experts, futures are some very